The Oz Principles definition of accountability can help revitalize the business character, strengthen the global competitiveness of corporations, heighten innovation, improve the quality of products and services produced by companies worldwide, and increase the responsiveness of organizations to the needs and wants of customers and constituents. Consider the following new definition of accountability, one that embodies the essence of the Oz Principle. Accountability: a personal choice to rise above one's circumstances and demonstrate the ownership necessary for achieving desired results, to see it, own it, solve it, and do it. This definition includes a mindset or attitude of continually asking, "What else can I do to rise above my circumstances and achieve the results I desire?" It involves a process of seeing it, owning it, solving it, and doing it, and requires a level of ownership that includes making, keeping, and answering for personal commitments. Such a perspective embraces both current and future efforts rather than reactive and historical explanations. Armed with this new definition of accountability, you can help yourself and others do everything possible to both overcome difficult circumstances and achieve desired results. The contemporary view of accountability tends to emphasize past actions as opposed to current or future efforts. Just as W. Edwards Deming has been telling business people for decades, most organizations operate on the assumption that the fear of failure will cause people to succeed. To the contrary, we feel such an assumption only causes people to prepare their explanations of history before the fact. Rather than focusing on powerful accountability, which stresses what you can do now to get better results, the customary definition impels people to account for what they have done in the past. This after-the-fact view of accountability prevents a before-it's-too-late approach. It should come as no surprise that the real value and benefit of accountability stems from a person's or an organization's ability to influence events and outcomes before they happen. The customary view of accountability fails to recognize that people can gain more from a proactive posture than from a reactive one. Take, for example, a situation that has intrigued us for some time. We have constantly been amazed at the manner in which local government officials determine when and where to install stop signs and traffic signals. We recall a particularly dangerous intersection with terrible visibility and horrendous traffic speeds. Traffic officials had been exceptionally slow to install traffic signals at this intersection. Rather than tracking complaints about the safety of the intersection, officials only tracked the number of accidents. After mishaps reach a certain number, officials install a stop sign. If a few fatalities occur, they erect a traffic signal. Now that many accidents and some fatalities have occurred at that bad intersection, it has graduated from a four-way stop sign to a traffic signal. How sad that it took pain, suffering, damage, and even lives to achieve the proper result. That's why we so dislike the reactive view of accountability and insist on a more proactive one instead. After the fact, it's too late to adjust behavior and avoid the negative consequences that can follow. Pop psychology, whether intentional or not, has often encouraged people in our society to blame all their woes and problems on a single or few experiences in their lives, thus promoting a lack of accountability for current and future behaviors, attitudes, and feelings. It is not unusual for people to explain their nightmares, eating disorders, compulsive cleanliness, anxieties, drive for self-improvement, physical ailments, financial problems, and impatience on some singular and pivotal problem or experience that occurred earlier in their lives. Blaming everything on their past wounds, they explain their vulnerability to fad diets, their awkwardness in relating to their children, or their feelings of alienation and loneliness, as if no other modern adult suffers these problems. The fact is, whether you are a true victim or a pseudo-victim, you will never overcome a hurtful past until you develop a present and future-oriented view of your own accountability for getting more out of life. To achieve such a shift in how you view things, we suggest that you start with our more powerful, more proactive definition of accountability. Joint accountability. The Oz Principles definition of accountability emphasizes the fact that accountability works best when people share ownership for circumstances and results. The old definition of accountability leads people to assign individual responsibility without acknowledging the shared accountability that so often characterizes organizational behavior and modern life. Not surprisingly, whenever the blame game signals out an individual as the one responsible for poor results, everyone else heaves a sigh of relief now that they're off the hook. Assigning singular responsibility may comfort the majority, but the fact remains organizational results come from collective, not individual, activity. Hence, when an organization fails to perform well, it represents, ultimately, a collective or shared failure. A complete understanding of accountability in organizations must include the principle of joint accountability. For example, imagine a baseball team where each defensive player assumes responsibility for covering an area of the field. No hard and fast rules prescribe the exact point where one player's area ends and another's begins. Given such overlapping areas of responsibility, getting good results, i.e. covering the whole field, becomes a team effort wherein individual accountability shifts according to circumstances, and coaches train players to go for the ball whenever they can reach it, even when more than one player can do so. For example, you've probably observed the occasion when a batter pops up a ball into shallow left center field. Immediately the shortstop, the left fielder, and the center fielder converge at the same time, with none of them completely sure who should catch the ball. Sometimes the ball gets dropped because the players run into one another, or thinking it could be anyone's ball, they all wait for the other guy to make the catch, not certain who will take responsibility for it this time. In many ways, the organizational game is a team sport, where everyone shoulders his or her individual responsibility, where everyone contributes to the final score, and where joint accountability governs play. One company president characterized what joint accountability meant to him this way: everyone working together so that we don't drop the ball, but when it does get dropped, everyone dives for the ball to pick it up. Unfortunately, he continued, too many of our people see the ball land on the ground between players, but react by saying, "That was your ball." In most organizations, it would be easy to recount a litany of projects in which someone had missed a critical deadline, incurred an unexpected expense, quit in the middle of a job, or failed to pay attention to a crucial detail. In such cases, no one jumps in to pick up the dropped ball. Everyone just sits smugly on the sideline saying, "Well, Bob or Sue really messed things up this time." This same company president described how his people used to think about quality. "We would ask who's accountable for quality." In response, he said, one hand would go up and everyone else would be pointing at them. Then he described how their thinking changed after understanding joint accountability. Today, when we ask who owns quality, all hands go up. One client enlisted our help in launching an information technology implementation of a system-wide integration of all information that would require a significant re-engineering of business processes. Since the client's executives worried about making the implementation work, they drew upon specialists from all over the company, with every major organizational function represented on the team. Getting this varied group of people to work together, particularly when people would need to make trade-offs to meet the highest priority, seemed a foreboding task. The fact that they had never seen an IT implementation come in on budget and on time only intensified their concerns. In the past, they would end up changing the due date 4 or 5 times and then run over budget. During the September kickoff, we helped the team create an environment of positive accountability for all of the behaviors and mindsets needed to accomplish the mission by September 5, exactly 1 year later. In effect, the executives created a culture of accountability emphasizing, "What else can I do to achieve the result?" rather than the traditional, "I'll just do my job." Amazingly, the implementation team worked into the night on the Saturday before the due date to finish 16 hours early and come in under budget. This was the first time in the company's history that IT achieved anything like this. The implementation now serves as the model for our client for all major IT implementations. In diagrams, we illustrate how creating joint accountability for results can impact performance in organizations. When people look at their accountability to the organization, they usually view it strictly in terms of their own individual responsibility. As a result, things tend to fall through the cracks because they fall outside the boundaries people have drawn around independent aspects of their job. Often organizations try to fix this problem by redefining roles, hiring more people, thus filling in the cracks by adding more circles, or restructuring the organization. However, when people view their accountability for results as something larger than their responsibility for doing their own job, they find themselves feeling accountable for things beyond what a literal interpretation of their job description might suggest, e.g. profits, customer complaints, sharing information, project deadlines, effective communications, sales, and the success of the overall company. When people assume this attitude of joint accountability for all aspects of a project, the cracks or boundaries disappear, and people see their ongoing responsibility as making sure the ball is not dropped. Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, remained vigilant in his quest for more joint accountability, or boundarylessness, as he called it. If this company is to achieve its goals, we've all got to become boundaryless. Boundaries are crazy. The union is just another boundary, and you have to reach across the same way you want to reach across the boundary separating you from your customers and your suppliers and your colleagues. For many people, the idea of joint accountability is elusive because they have been programmed to think only in terms of the one responsible rather than the group responsible. Yet, you may ask, can people in an organization really assume accountability for the same things, the same results? Doesn't that translate to no one being responsible? Not at all. In their book, Revolutionizing Product Development, Kim Clark, Dean of the Harvard Business School, and co-author Stephen Wheelwright describe the significant strategic and competitive advantages that result when team members understand this concept of joint accountability. After forming product development core teams consisting of dedicated personnel from various functional departments in the organization, they observe. Each core team member wears a functional hat which makes him or her the focal point and manager responsible for a function that delivers its unique contribution to the overall project. But each core team member also wears a team hat. In addition to representing his or her function, each core team member accepts responsibility for overall team results. In this role, the core team shares responsibility with the heavyweight project manager for the development procedures followed by the team, and for the overall results that those procedures deliver. The core team is accountable for the success of the project and can blame no one but itself if it fails to manage the project, execute the tasks, and deliver the performance agreed upon at the outset. What is unique in the core team members' responsibilities is not so much their accountability for tasks in their own function, but the fact that they are responsible for how those tasks are subdivided, organized, and accomplished. Yet it is vital that each individual in an organization be accountable, but in addition, they must also share joint accountability with others. Consider the following story. A manufacturer of dishwashers and other home appliances ran two parallel assembly lines, separated by a row of inventory handling offices and storage units. Each line functioned autonomously for the most part, and each developed its own unique operating culture. Under the leadership of the line supervisor, the workers on assembly line 1 became adept at quickly identifying a faulty sub-assembly from any one of the 20 workstations on the line. When someone identified a bad sub-assembly, the supervisor immediately confronted the operator responsible for the problem and, with everyone watching, embarrassed that person into correcting the problem and improving future performance. Naturally, everyone else on the line, protected by an illusion of safety, would blame the erring operator for slowing them down. Over time, however, people began hiding their mistakes, hoping to remain sheltered from blame, and would not acknowledge an error even when confronted by the supervisor. As a result, production output had been declining and defective sub-assemblies and scrap had been increasing for several months. Next door, on assembly line 2, the workers had developed a markedly different kind of operating culture. When an operator made a mistake at a workstation, other workers would immediately offer assistance in solving the problem quickly and without a lot of discussion. Functioning as part of a team, each worker felt jointly accountable for the end result of assembling quality products on time. free from the illusion of safety created by explanations and victim stories, the workers appreciated and helped one another, quickly identifying mistakes, but never accusing one individual of hurting the group effort. As a result, production on Line 2 remained high, with defective subassemblies and scrap near zero. The workers on Assembly Line 1 spent a lot of time below the line, denying their errors, blaming each other for mistakes, and generally walking, talking, and thinking like victims. In contrast, the workers on Assembly Line 2 enjoyed their work, liked working with each other, felt fulfilled, and got great results. Organizational behaviorists could speak eloquently about the many differences between these two work cultures, citing innumerable variables that explain the differences in results. But we see one fundamental difference between the two. One practiced joint accountability, the other did not. In his best-selling book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen R. Covey observes, "On the maturity continuum, dependence is the paradigm of you. You take care of me. You come through for me. You didn't come through. I blame you for the results. Independence is the paradigm of I. I can do it. I am responsible. I am self-reliant. I can choose. Interdependence is the paradigm of we. We can do it. We can cooperate. We can combine our talents and abilities and create something greater together." We think that while dependent people need others to get what they want and independent people attempt to get what they want through their own effort, interdependent people combine the best of both worlds. The most powerful working environments apply the principles of interdependence and joint accountability, where people don't fear accountability, but teach and coach each other in order to win whatever game they're playing. While each individual accepts accountability for his or her own performance and results, each also knows that it takes teamwork and a sense of shared responsibility to achieve overall objectives. For people working in such environments, accountability propels everyone forward. Yes, you still must account for your own mistakes, but you know such an accounting will drive toward a better future. In such an environment, people spend less time and fewer resources creating excuses and more time and resources uncovering problems, taking risks, and initiating positive action to solve problems. Learning replaces punishment, success replaces failure, and victimization gives way to accountability. When problems like product recalls, missed sales targets, or cost overruns arise in organizations where joint accountability hasn't taken root, you'd better look out, because you are in for a large dose of apathy and finger-pointing. Too often, unaffected departments sit on the sidelines and rest quietly, relieved that the problem lies outside their realm of accountability, grateful that they are not the one on the critical path. In contrast, people functioning in an environment of joint accountability realize that the problems extend beyond functional lines and often require solutions that necessitate wide-scale involvement. Recall when the astronauts on Apollo 13 uttered the immortal words, "Houston, we have a problem." Can you picture people on the ground standing around and waiting for someone to do something? No way. Instead, those words prompted quick action. People scrambled, offered assistance, and anticipated related contingencies that could develop. There was only one problem, everyone's problem, and we had to solve it. How do we bring our men safely home? But how does joint accountability really work, and how do you manage it? How do you avoid getting dragged below the line when someone with whom you share accountability gets stuck in the victim cycle? Joint accountability can be hard to find because it can be so difficult to create. Can you create an environment where people collectively own achieving the result, but do so without surrendering individual accountability? At what point does one's quest to help solve the problem actually get in the way of engaging others in doing the same? Can my own individual accountability obfuscate another's? When do we cross the line into confusion where everyone feels accountable for everything? Tough questions, and they require tough answers. Helping people ring the bell. All answers to these questions come from a total focus on results within its organization. When everyone is accountable for achieving organizational results and not just doing her job, the right things tend to happen. When people make a direct connection between their job and the organization's desired results, they breathe purpose and vision into their lives and become highly motivated. It all hinges on getting people to work on the right things and to know why they're doing what they're doing at every level in the organization. Otherwise, they can get lost in the process of doing the job and lose their focus on results. One client, the leader of an international sales group, met this problem head-on. Within his developing sales organization, people naturally focused on process, on how they did their jobs. Those in the field who were traveling heavily away from home and family for weeks at a time began to feel burdened by the process, and that distracted them from concentrating on the results that mattered most. How could the leader turn that around? How could he get everyone in the department constantly thinking about what mattered most, making the sale? In short, how could he keep them from getting lost in process? Pondering this question, he hit upon a simple idea. One morning, he installed a large bell on the wall outside his office in full view of the department. Whenever someone closed a sale, he would clang the bell repeatedly. It made quite a racket. As you might imagine, the bell caught people's attention, not only in the department, but throughout the company as well. Before long, everyone began to talk in terms of doing things that would ring the bell. They knew the bell would not ring for procedures and policies, for processes and posturings, but for concrete results. Clanging bells can come in all shapes and sizes, from bonuses and rewards to words of glowing praise. What can you do to get people to focus on the things that ring the bell in your organization? This is, perhaps, the greatest challenge of leadership, made all the more difficult by today's fast-paced, technology-driven environment. It's just so easy for all the noise to drown out all the bell's clear ring. To keep our own organization focused on results in the face of noisy activity, we speak of ringing the bell often. When new projects begin, a discussion ensues about what, at the end of the day, rings the bell. Our people translate this phrase to mean, we know there are a lot of things we need to do to make this happen. We also know that some of these things may be extremely difficult and may seriously test our team, but in the end, we've accomplished nothing until we get this one most important result. Again, accountability begins, without exception, with clearly defining the results you want and need to achieve. Throughout the chapters in Part 1 of this book, we have tried to show how people in organizations can succumb to the temptation to seek protection below the line. When they do so, they become experts at concocting explanations and victim stories. While that may provide an illusion of safety, that illusion is easily shattered by reality. The benefits of applying accountability. The Oz Principle Way. Viewing accountability the Oz Principle way doesn't come without its costs. You must abandon the whole whodunit game and the illusion of safety that arises when you pin blame on someone else. You must also become more involved both in coaching others and in checking yourself, always bearing in mind the need for both individual and joint accountability. In our experience, however, the benefits far outweigh the costs. You save the costs of endless explanations from people hiding below the line. You save the costs of missed results that stem from insufficient action. You save the costs of all the dropped balls someone must sooner or later pick up. And you save the cost of wasted time spent micromanaging everything and everybody in sight. To illustrate the benefits of applying accountability the Oz Principle way, consider Dennis Antinori, the vice president of sales for what used to be IVAC, a large medical products company, who anxiously awaited an upcoming national sales meeting at which the company would launch several new products. 2 months before the meeting, Dennis received word that the new products would be a full 12 months late. Astonished by the news, he struggled with three enormous challenges. One, how to keep himself above the line, refrain from blaming the new product development people for his predicament, and working to hit his numbers without the help of new products. Two, how to help his sales management team stay above the line. And three, how to assist his sales managers in keeping their sales reps committed to achieving their sales targets despite the lack of new products. Having learned to operate above the line and view accountability in a new light, Dennis met with his 18 sales managers to take a new look at their circumstances. After letting people spend some time below the line in the victim cycle, concocting reasons for why they felt let down by the rest of the company, Dennis consciously moved the discussion above the line. Viewed from above the line, the huge obstacles to achieving sales targets still look formidable, but not insurmountable. Dennis asked, given the obstacles we face, and they are huge ones, what else can we do to rise above these circumstances and achieve the results we want and the company needs? At first, the question baffled the sales managers. How, they asked, do you solve a new products problem without new products? That's not our real problem, Dennis suggested. The real problem is a sales problem, not a new products problem. We must accept the reality that we will receive no new products this year and that the company still needs us to hit our numbers. Assigning blame to the new product development folks won't remove our responsibility to deliver on budgeted sales. After much lengthy discussion, the team climbed above the line and began asking, what else can we do to achieve this year's sales targets, despite no new products? In the months following this meeting, Dennis Antonori and his sales management team found many new and creative ways to boost sales and meet the targets set at the beginning of the year. By year's end, they turned in an outstanding performance, one of the best in the history of the company, a healthy 15% increase in sales over the previous year. 1 year after the accountability session, Dennis and his sales management team got together a few weeks prior to the national sales meeting. During the discussions, Dennis asked his team, what most contributed to our sales success last year? As he recounts, everyone felt that we took an above-the-line approach to the situation, wasted no time blaming new product development, and really challenged ourselves to find and implement solutions positively rather than negatively. When the bull charged, we took it by the horns and wrestled it to the ground. We got focused rather than frustrated, and we made it happen despite the odds stacked against us. Looking for people who are reaping or failing to reap the benefits of accountability. As we read the newspaper and watch or listen to the news on any given day, we see the Oz principle repeatedly applied and ignored. In fact, we decided to test this theory by randomly choosing a day and then searching the paper to see the Oz principle at work or not. We picked income tax filing day, April 15, in the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the London Times, the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. In the Los Angeles Times, we found a story about L-tryptophan and Betsy DeRosa. As you read the following excerpt, you might take a minute to think about who was accountable and who could have been more accountable in this story. 2 years after taking the over-the-counter sleeping aid L-tryptophan, schoolteacher Betsy DeRosa began suffering skin blotches, joint and muscle cramps, tingling in her arms and legs, even damage to her heart and lungs. The symptoms remained with DeRosa and with thousands of other victims of L-tryptophan, which was lifted from shelves across the country and is now the focal point of about 1,500 lawsuits brought by victims of the debilitating disease, EMS, for which L-tryptophan is blamed. This week, DeRosa, 42, became the first plaintiff in the nation to win a lawsuit against Showa Denka KK, the Japanese manufacturer of the pill. But DeRosa and her attorney reacted with disappointment Wednesday, saying they had hoped for more than the jury's award of slightly more than $1 million. The article goes on to say she was upset about the jury's verdict, saying she continued taking L-tryptophan after watching a news report that said a handful of people in New Mexico had developed mild symptoms as a result of using the pills. DeRosa exclaimed, "There was no mention of recalls, and I never saw another report. L-tryptophan was still on the shelves, with no warning sign anywhere in sight. I don't feel the least bit responsible for causing all the horrible things that have happened to me. Was it really my fault?" DeRosa had been seeking $144 million, but received less than even the $1.5 million offered in a proposed settlement by Showa Denka KK. The jury found DeRosa partially at fault because she continued taking the pill after news accounts warning of its dangers. After the case concluded, Showa Denka's attorney, John Nyhan, said, "The result should tell the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' lawyers that jurors do not believe the company should be punished for its conduct." But then, according to DeRosa's attorney, Patrick McCormick, fault has been established. "We clearly showed that Showa Denka KK manufactured a defective product, one that never obtained FDA approval, and which has had a devastating impact." As with most victim stories, there are clearly two sides to this case. both DeRosa and Shawadenka could have done more to avoid the tragedy. Shawadenka could have performed more testing and gained FDA approval before marketing its product. DeRosa could have stopped taking the pill as soon as she learned there might be a problem with the product. The jury rightly faulted Shawadenka for producing a bad product, but honestly, the money DeRosa received seems inadequate compensation for the difficulty she has faced and will continue to face throughout her life because of L-tryptophan. However, the jury based its decision on the principle of what else might DeRosa have done. Think of the situation in light of the Tylenol tampering scare a few years ago. How many people, when they first heard of the tampering problems, stopped buying and using the product? How many people waited for the recall before they stopped using Tylenol? In our opinion, accountable consumers immediately discarded their Tylenol capsules and waited until Johnson & Johnson assured them that it had removed the risk of product tampering before they resumed using the product. DeRosa's story highlights an important aspect of the Oz principle. Even when we are truly victimized, as Betsy DeRosa was, we may still show some accountability for the outcomes that we experience. To be sure, you can be a 100% victim, but it probably happens a lot less often than you might think or want to believe. In the Boston Globe, we found the insightful story of two sixth-grade conflict managers, Cheryl Mothy and Kerry McManus. When grade 6 students Cheryl Mothy and Kerry McManus put on their pink baseball hats and head out to patrol the playground at Betty Gibson School, they go looking for trouble. The two girls are conflict managers, part of a program at the Brandon Elementary School where students mediate non-physical disputes among their fellow schoolmates during recess. "It's a good feeling knowing that you're putting effort into making our playgrounds a safer place," Cheryl says. "We're helping people instead of them just getting into fights," adds Kerry. The conflict managers, who have been patrolling the school's playground since March 8, are not supposed to try to solve problems themselves, take sides, or break up fights. Instead, they're taught to ask the children involved how the problem can be solved, how to avoid future fights, and attempt to get an agreement from everyone involved. What marvelous above-the-line behavior! How might schools today improve if kids on all our playgrounds help their schoolmates talk rather than fight, encourage those with conflicts to find their own solutions, and identified conflict as something that does not need to mar school life? Each of these examples and many others appeared in the news on one day. As you read or watch the news today, look for examples of people reaping or failing to reap the benefits of accountability. It won't take long for you to see the need for the Oz principle in virtually every aspect of human behavior. Preparing to climb the steps to accountability. Throughout this chapter, we have redefined accountability and shown how the Oz principle definition can help you more fully appreciate the difference between below-the-line and above-the-line behavior. To summarize this chapter and the importance of purposefully moving above the line, we'd like to share the following story. In the early 1990s, Guidant Cardiac Rhythm Management, then known as CPI, made an unyielding commitment to improve new product development. At the time, Guidant CRM had not produced a major new product in years, and the attitude in the industry was that the company couldn't develop its way out of a paper bag. At that time, then-President Jay Graff described the company as an organization going 90 miles per hour on an icy road headed toward a cliff because no one is willing to take responsibility for the situation, and worse, no one really understands how bad things are. Despite all the clear signs of the company's precarious competitive situation, many people in the organization focused on coping with growth as its biggest problem, unwilling to recognize or acknowledge the impending product development challenges that could easily knock them below the line. Jay could foresee the competition's eventual rise to unquestioned market leadership just 2 years down the line, and he feared that their continuous introduction of high-quality new products into the market would create a game of leapfrog that would keep CRM in a defensive posture and render its products also-rans as soon as they hit the market. As Guidant CRM began to see it, management noted that as engineers were designing a device, someone would always request an additional feature. The engineers would definitely deliver on the additional feature, and then someone else would request another feature. It was clear to management that CRM would never deliver a new product if they continued to succumb to what they referred to as creeping elegance. As this fundamental problem was recognized company-wide, they began to address it with concerted effort. They implemented frequent project review meetings that provided more timely coaching and guidance for product development teams. They put into effect a new system of succession planning that distinguished between top players who accepted accountability for results and those who failed to do so. Ultimately, they involved the entire company in a process of organizational transition that focused the company on changing the corporate culture from one characterized by finger-pointing, confusion, and complacency to one noted for accountability and ownership. Over the next few years, Guidant took accountability for delivering new products to the marketplace. People throughout the organization ceased to react solely in terms of their product development strategy. They aligned around a concept for a new product, and then they delivered. Over the next few years, Guidant CRM became what management referred to as a new product development machine, delivering 14 new products in just 14 months. It is interesting to note, according to Barb Reindl, Vice President of HR at Guidant CRM, that while new product development has become a significant and dependable strength of our company, today's markets have changed from the early 90s. No longer is it sufficient to just have great technology. As Guidant worked to produce the world's smallest and most sophisticated defibrillator in the late 1990s, many people had been placed on mandatory overtime for about a year because of the impact this device was certain to have on the company's performance. Management at Guidant was shocked when their innovative and highly celebrated product did no more than bump the business a little in market share. J. Miller Hagen, Director of Heart Failure Marketing, explained that because of the company's singleness of vision, Guidant would release a great new product and then stand around and say, "We don't get it. Why doesn't it take us to number one in market share?" "It was a real wake-up call," said Deal Huffam, Director of Quality Assurance. "Our approach, that the best technology will keep us on top, had been shattered. It was going to take more than that." Reality had hit Guidant right between the eyes for the second time in a decade. Once again, this management team took accountability to shift the way they viewed their business. They began to think about their business from the patient and customer perspective instead of from an internal R&D-only viewpoint. They put patients and customers first. They emphasized their role as a company in Guidant. They energized their people around this new view and created great emotional appeal through their organization. Additionally, Guidant focused on the results of a key study as a way to energize both customers and employees. The company had pioneered the practice of sponsoring clinical trials in defibrillator therapy. While the results from one major trial helped identify patients who needed defibrillators, only 20% of them were actually receiving a device. Janet Babka, Director of Quality Information and Technology, observed, "The results of a more recent study showed even more people needing device therapy. If they did nothing, the number of high-risk people receiving a device was going to decline further." Acknowledging the reality of the current tragedy, Guidant rallied to action. Instead of focusing only on how their devices were different from competitors, they started focusing their message on the larger issue, the people that were needlessly dying without therapy. They worked to change this reality and consequently to change the very dynamics of the industry. Guidant CRM began steering toward a new understanding of competitiveness, which went beyond great products to include great sales, service, technical support, training, and every other aspect of their business. They began to focus on doing 20 things well rather than just two or three. Finally, Guidant CRM focused on improving its message and its distribution system. They took accountability for how they were viewed in the marketplace. The experts would attest to the fact that Guidant CRM's products were superior, but everyone agreed that Guidant CRM had failed to declare that same message. Guidant CRM ultimately acknowledged that great technology doesn't sell itself. Today, every strategic imperative ends with the phrase, "and get credit for all of it." As for its distribution system, Guidant CRM's U.S. sales force has expanded more than fivefold, from 215 reps in 1997 to 1,134 reps in 2003. Climbing the steps to accountability. It takes time, effort, commitment, and sometimes even emotional trauma to get onto the steps to accountability and stay there. but we have never found an individual or organization who, after experiencing life above the line, wanted to return to the blame game. You may slip. In fact, you will slip. However, you'll know you're slipping, and you'll want to catch yourself before you sink too far. In Chapter 2, we provided some telltale signs of getting stuck in the victim cycle so you could recognize below-the-line attitudes and behavior. We'd like to conclude this chapter with some telltale signs of climbing the steps to accountability that can help you remain above the line. In the next four chapters, we will address the various steps to accountability. You can improve your own ability to remain above the line by watching for the following clues that indicate accountable attitudes and behavior. You invite candid feedback from everyone about your own performance. You never want anyone, including yourself, to hide the truth from you. You readily acknowledge reality, including all its problems and challenges. You don't waste time or energy on things you cannot control or influence. You always commit yourself 100% to what you are doing, and if your commitment begins to wane, you strive to rekindle it. You own your circumstances and your results, even when they seem less than desirable. You recognize when you are dropping below the line and act quickly to avoid the traps of the victim cycle. You delight in the daily opportunity to make things happen. And you constantly ask yourself the question, what else can I do to rise above my circumstances and get the results I want? When you act and think in these ways, you're functioning above the line. Rising above your circumstances to get the results you seek is the soul of the Oz Principle, just as it was the empowering theme in L. Frank Baum's Land of Oz. Part 2. The power of individual accountability, moving yourself above the line. The universally applicable steps to accountability, see it, own it, solve it, and do it, weave the tapestry of every business success scenario without exception. In Part 2, we examine each of the steps to accountability, one at a time, to help you understand, internalize, and apply each step. You'll learn how to muster the courage to see and acknowledge reality. Find the heart to own your circumstances, no matter how difficult that may prove to be. Obtain the wisdom to solve any problem or overcome any obstacle that stands in your way. And exercise the means to make things happen, allowing you to get the results you want. Chapter 4. The Lion Mustering the Courage to See It. "Do you think Oz could give me courage?" asked the Cowardly Lion. "Just as easily as he could give me brains," said the Scarecrow. "Or give me a heart," said the Tin Woodsman. "Or send me back to Kansas," said Dorothy. "Then, if you don't mind, I'll go with you," said the Lion, "for my life is simply unbearable without a bit of courage." The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum. It always takes courage to acknowledge the reality of a difficult situation, and even the most heralded institutions can fail to do so. Sharing Plow recently recalled almost 60 million of its inhalers because some of them did not contain the necessary active ingredients for alleviating asthma attacks. Critics like Dr. Sidney Wolfe, director of Public Citizens Health Research Group, have called it bad management and sloppy manufacturing. Long known for its disciplined manufacturing, Sharing Plow began surprising analysts, shareholders, and eventually customers in recent years with a growing number of product recalls, FDA fines, and sanctions. Apparently, management poured money into marketing and sales for blockbuster products such as Claritin, while delaying plant upgrades and over-relying on the past strength of manufacturing systems. Fortunately, Sharing Plow's executives are demonstrating the sort of courage we'd like to see from all corporations. CEO Richard Cogan told shareholders, "I am taking full responsibility for resolving these matters in a timely manner and securing the FDA's confidence." He launched a manufacturing improvement program, formed a worldwide quality operations unit to address quality issues, implemented technology upgrades, added hundreds of quality control people and scientists to make the changes last, and established a review board composed of former FDA officials to oversee FDA compliance. Congratulations to Sharing Plough, CEO Kogan, and the entire executive team. It takes courage to see reality, admit mistakes, and recognize the need for improvement, the first step to rising above the line. It isn't easy to see reality, and you can't do it overnight, but you will get there much more quickly if you proceed one sure step at a time. As you begin taking the first step above the line, bear in mind the words of Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, who defines management as looking really straight in the eye and then acting upon it with as much speed as you can. Taking the first step above the line. Even the most accountable people get stuck in the victim cycle from time to time, and sometimes people who usually practice accountability can get stuck on a particular challenge. Regardless of whether you're stuck below the line all the time or only on a particular pesky problem, you must still take the first step out of the victim cycle by recognizing that you are stuck in a circle of denial. That recognition requires the courage to acknowledge the reality of your situation, no matter how unpleasant or unfair that reality may seem. Without such acknowledgement, you can never expect to respond to it effectively. According to Andrew S. Grove, chairman of Intel, every company faces a critical point when it must change dramatically to rise to the next level of performance. If the company fails to see and seize that moment, it will start to decline. The key is courage. It's astonishing to see giants such as Enron, WorldCom, and Arthur Andersen, at one time the unchallenged leaders in their respective world markets, suddenly fall. In a short period of time, hundreds of thousands of people became victims of the actions of a relative few. However, in the mire created by such circumstances, many courageous people are taking bold actions to see the reality of their situations and to stave off further calamity. Take, for instance, one intimate interview with Jim Copeland, CEO of Deloitte & Touche. In this interview, Fortune magazine reporters captured the essence of this CEO's choice to face reality. As the news that employees in Arthur Andersen's Houston office had destroyed thousands of Enron-related documents scrolled across a TV news ticker one afternoon in early January, Copeland's stomach turned. He knew instinctively that the focus of all the public outrage, the government investigations, and the breathless media coverage would shift to Andersen and, by extension, to the rest of the accounting profession. Copeland, knowing his firm would not escape scrutiny and criticism, mustered the courage to face the situation head-on. One of the toughest realities he had to face was the need to separate consulting services, a very lucrative part of the firm, from accounting and auditing services. Deloitte and Touche had long tied consulting and accounting services together because of the natural synergies and benefits to clients, and the firm was committed to maintaining that strategy until one morning when Manoj Singh, head of the firm's consulting services business in the United States, showed up in Copeland's office. Fortune reported the pivotal moment. Singh had just learned that a big audit client was backing out of a contract to use Deloitte Consulting for a multi-million dollar restructuring and cost reduction study. The client was concerned about the perception of a conflict. Copeland nodded sadly and picked up the phone. He dialed Douglas McCracken, the head of Deloitte Consulting Worldwide, and William Parrott, the managing partner for Deloitte's American Accounting Tax and Related Services. That afternoon, the four men, Copeland, McCracken, Singh, and Parrott, locked themselves in a conference room for 5 hours. They emerged, Copeland recalls, with tears in their eyes. They began working the phones, hosting marathon conference calls with partners around the world. Their message was simple. The one firm model was dead. Deloitte and Touche would reluctantly separate from Deloitte Consulting. With that message, the whole company took one firm step above the line. Why people fail to see it. People most frequently fail to see reality because they choose to ignore or accept changes in the external environment. For example, the Wall Street Journal reported that Connie Plourd and the other sales representatives at American Telephone and Telegraph Company's Sacramento, California office lost their desks. They were given laptop computers, cellular telephones, and portable printers, and told to create virtual offices at home or at their customers' offices. It wasn't an easy change for the extroverted 19-year AT&T veteran who delighted in the camaraderie of the workplace. Until the real estate people came in and started moving our cubicles out, we just continued to come in, she recalls. It was a comfort zone, I guess. ignoring or refusing to deal with such a change can quickly thrust you below the line. Dun & Bradstreet's Michael Bell, one of a new breed of corporate real estate managers, was surprised to encounter such strong resistance to AT&T's telecommuting initiative. Why couldn't people see that the office isn't a place to come, sit down and stare at a computer screen or talk on the phone all day? If you want to do that, you can do it at home. Even corporate decision makers who climbed the corporate ladder at a time when clout was measured by office size and location found it hard to embrace what Mr. Bell has dubbed the unrealestating of corporate America. Resistance to such a trend could, however, undermine the competitiveness of a company that has found itself in a dogfight for market share. Larry Ebert, director of real estate at Ernst & Young, says there will be a lot of cultural resistance to such office changes. If those changes are inevitable, then those who resist them will inevitably fail. In another case of people failing to see reality and accept their own responsibility for that reality, consider the current family dysfunction game. While most people agree that the home environment affects a person's habits, it has become fashionable, even epidemic, for adult children to blame all their woes on dysfunctional childhood homes. Who do you blame for compulsive shopping disorders, sex addictions, poor eating habits, alcoholism, spouse and child abuse, work ruts, personality disorders, uncontrollable urges to please others? Everyone but yourself, it seems. It's not my fault, it's my family's fault. Talk show hosts from Oprah Winfrey to Jerry Springer daily exploit America's penchant for playing the dysfunction game by parading celebrities as well as ordinary people across the nation's television screens, perpetuating the notion that none of us need shoulder full responsibility for our problems. The raging popularity of such shows emphasizes just how much the nation's television audiences enjoy hearing other people recount their victim stories. In turn, many TV watchers use such victim stories to justify their own below-the-line behavior, making the blame game a new national pastime. After all, according to popular lecturer and author John Bradshaw, 96% of the population comes from dysfunctional families. While we agree that family problems can plague people far beyond their childhoods, we take issue with Bradshaw's claim, not just because we question the accuracy of the percentage, but because reliance on that percentage lets 96% of the population off the hook for their current behavior. If you comfort yourself with the knowledge that 96% of your fellow Americans can blame their dysfunctional families for their problems, you're probably stuck in the victim cycle. Oh, you may justly feel that early experiences have contributed to your problems, but chalking everything up to those problems prevents you from taking charge of your life and doing something about your problems. In this sense, the current dysfunctional fad strikes us as just one more indicator of people's inability and unwillingness to acknowledge their own accountability. Indeed, the whole dysfunctional movement would strike us as funny if it didn't pose such a dangerous threat to our country's well-being. Consider, for instance, these excuses for overdrafts at the now-defunct House Bank for the U.S. House of Representatives, as reported in the Wall Street Journal during 1992. Number one, Representative Mary Rose Okar, a Democrat from Ohio who sat on the House Administration Committee that oversaw the House Bank and racked up 217 overdrafts, said, "When I came to Congress, they didn't tell us there was another way to get your check." Number two, Representative Robert Mrazek, a Democrat from New York with 972 overdrafts,